Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and discuss the extrajudicial killing of two American citizens by the American government that has largely been met with widespread approval and praise. U.S. constitutional lawyer Bruce Fein, who served as Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall, joins us to determine the implications for our civil liberties at home now that the U.S. appears to have a license to kill its own citizens, and the blowback abroad that might aid our enemies. Then we will discuss the fallout of the killings of the alleged leaders of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, al-Laki and Khan, on Yemen, and how it will impact the power struggle between the family of the 33-year-long dictatorship of President Saleh and the democracy movement inspired by the Arab Spring that has the country on the brink of civil war and poised to be a failed state. While Saleh is taking credit along with the United States, we'll discuss this with a visiting professor at American University in Cairo and the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, Sheila Carapico. She questions why we continue to fixate on al-Qaeda and support the Saudi peace initiative that is going nowhere instead of siding with the democracy movement in Yemen. Then finally, we'll discuss our own Arab Spring, the American Autumn, as protests continue in New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and around the country against Wall Street and the shrinkage of the middle class, the impoverishment of working Americans, and the growing wealth and political power of America's oligarchy. Veteran New York Times correspondent and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges joins us to ask whether you are a rebel or a slave. Joining us now is Bruce Fein, who is a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration. He was General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international laws, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fein is the author of Constitutional Peril, the Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire, Before the Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein.
Well, I'm grateful to appear.
And you believe that the extrajudicial killing of the two American citizens, Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, in Yemen, you say it was as lawless an act for the United States as was Russian President Vladimir Putin's extrajudicial killing by poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko in London.
Yes, and one of the things I'd like to begin with is you and all the listeners and myself need to ask, what do we do to keep off of President Obama's assassination list? We don't know what standards were utilized to place Mr. al-Awlaki there. I'm told that there are at least four other names on there, but this is a unilateral decision of the president. There's no due process. There's no checks and balances. He just decides unilaterally, all right, you're on the assassination list. That's not what we call the rule of law. It's not reflective of a country that understands individual liberty and process is the essence of any democratic dispensation. Remember what we know publicly, that Mr. al-Awlaki was not on a battlefield. He was not engaged in active hostilities against the United States. It seems, although he was not even indicted for any particular crime, unlike Osama bin Laden, who had been indicted prior to his killing. But if there was evidence, and there seems to be at least in the public record evidence, that Mr. al-Awlaki was providing material support for a foreign terrorist organization, there are ways to indict. There are justifications for the use of deadly force in seeking to apprehend a fleeing felon who could create a serious danger to physical safety of third parties. The Constitution is not a suicide pact. The rule of law does make accommodations to defeat great danger, but it's done with proper process. I say this establishes a precedent that will lie around like a loaded weapon, ready for any president to stick anyone's name on an assassination list, and that we'll be back to the pre-Magna Carta days of King John.
And obviously that has grave implications for all of our civil liberties, the notion that the United States government can kill U.S. citizens with impunity. What's your argument, though, about blowback abroad?
Well, this is the first of all, let's just underscore that the battlefield in the eyes of the Obama administration, I think this was true with regard to Bush as well, is everywhere in the world. You, Ian, are on a battlefield. I, sitting in my office, are on a battlefield. You can't escape it anywhere on the planet. I mean, maybe it'll even go interstellar. So that means, under his precedent, anyone who the president says is affiliated with al-Qaeda could be assassinated in the United States, in an airport. If Mr. Awlaki had tried to perhaps smuggle his way back into the United States and landed at O'Hare, Los Angeles Airport, under the president's theory, we could send the military or even crash a Predator drone in to kill him. So hey, this is not limited to a faraway country of which most Americans know little. But then the second issue about the blowback, you know, what is the precedent with regard to the nature of international law that could come back and very much endanger the United States? It is the idea of what kind of a danger is imminent. Now, traditionally in the law, an imminent danger is one that will happen momentarily. For example, someone picks up a knife and is about ready to stab you. You don't have to wait for him actually to stab you before you can undertake self-defense. You know, there's ocular evidence that you were in immediate danger. Now, this case with regard to Awlaki was said to be one where he was in imminent danger to the United States. Well, that destroys the whole idea of imminent, because he wasn't picking up AK-47s. He wasn't involved on a battlefield. He wasn't actively conspiring to develop a plan, a particular plan to attack the United States, or at least not. There was no evidence of that. The idea of imminence was based upon the notion that he goes on the Internet, and there's no doubt that he may incite or encourage others to act in ways that that certainly could be criminal. It might well be an unlawful solicitation of a crime. But that doesn't mean that the danger is an imminent one that provides no opportunity to undertake the ordinary course of the law, as I say, which includes deadly force if you try to flee from capture after having been indicted, and simply resort to assassination. And so the idea seems to be that imminent is, well, sometime in the future, because the language is incendiary, somebody might get inspired by it, like Colonel Hassan. People say that they listened to Awlaki, but many others, and maybe his words caused them to resort to criminality, and therefore he's in imminent danger. You know, that would enable, if that's an imminent danger, the United States itself is an imminent danger to probably a billion Muslims around the world. You know, the Predator drones make errors. We don't know the extent of it because it's secret what the postmortems are on the use of Predator drones as to how many civilians were killed. But certainly we have not ruled out using Predator drones against anyone we decide for whatever reason we think suggests that they're implicated or sympathetic to terrorism. We can kill them. So that basically gives foreign countries a license to attack the United States on the idea is, well, since we basically said all the world's a battlefield that we can use the military on, then they're engaged in self-defense when they strike back even before we've actually launched a Predator drone or some other kind of weapon.
Again, I'm speaking with Bruce Fein, constitutional lawyer, formerly served as a Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration and is the author of American Empire Before the Fall. But when you say we can strike anywhere and wars, there are no borders anymore, that's the rubric under which the war on terror is structured. Is there any legal rationale for that? And, you know, obviously during World War II, a lot of Nazis slipped ashore, spies on U-boats. They were captured and executed. Was that legal? Is there any kind of legal frame?
Okay, but that's different. It's the case called in the lawyers at Ex Parte Quir and the Nazi saboteurs. Well, they came to the United States, you know, and they were captured in the United States. They were not executed. They were tried before a military commission. They were convicted before a military commission. And the case got to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, there are perhaps flaws in the process, but they were not summarily executed.
Some of them were, though, weren't they?
In the United States, no. That's not true.
Oh, really? I thought some got executed, but are you saying they all served prison time?
No. They did get executed, but it was after a trial. I mean, we executed Timothy McVeigh, too. We gave him a trial, and we executed him.
I see.
And you're correct that they were executed, but it wasn't an assassination.
Right.
And moreover, they were on United States soil. Mr. Awaki wasn't on United States soil. He's in Yemen. And he wasn't on a battlefield in Yemen. He wasn't engaged in active hostilities against the United States. So it destroys the basic former clear line between civilian activity and military activity.
So how do you feel, Bruce, that we're probably the only two people on the planet raising questions about this? This thing has been greeted by praise. The president had a photo op, getting cheered about it. I mean, this is not an unpopular move, that the killing of Bin Laden, the killing of Awlaki and Khan.
No, I certainly agree with you, and that shows the book that I wrote, American Empire, The Psychology of Empire, has now pervaded all of the culture of the United States, or most of it, and that all that matters is the ends. The means don't matter anymore. And that's why there's complacency with regard to military commissions. There's complacency with regard to blocking victims of kidnapping and torture from redress against the government by invoking state secrets. There's complacency with detentions without accusation or charge at Guantanamo or at Bagram. The Constitution has become a joke. And due process no longer matters because people believe, I think generally, that the names they hear about as being the victims of the lawlessness seem very foreign. Awaki, Boumediene, Hamdan, Hamdi. It's like, well, it's not going to happen to me, so let's just go after and flex our muscles and destroy what we perceive to be our opponents. Now, it will come back to haunt us. They say these precedents lie around like loaded weapons, and at one time they well could be used in the United States against us. And let me give this hypothetical for your audience to ponder. Suppose the president of the United States tonight, and it wouldn't have to be Obama, because I don't believe this is a personality issue. But the President of the United States goes on the television tonight and says, I've got secret intelligence that shows, there are going to be 5 attempts at second editions of 9/11 against United States citizens in the major cities around the country. In order to make you safe, I have to suspend the Constitution. But I'll give you your civil liberties back as soon as I can. I'll recall Congress after I dissolve it as soon as I can. I'll reinstate the U.S. Supreme Court as soon as I can. But we can no longer afford the luxury of believing that freedoms and due process and liberty has any role in a time of grave immediate crisis. Now, I believe that if the president made such a statement, the United States people would not be out on the streets protesting and insisting we have to impeach and remove this president because he's attempting to subvert the Constitution. I do not believe the Congress of the United States would vote articles of impeachment. I think generally we have a psychology would say, if we have to be vassals and serfs to be safe, we'd rather be vassals and serfs and be safe than take the tiniest risk for freedom.
Well, and Bruce, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, and your point is well taken, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with constitutional lawyer Bruce Fine, who served as Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration. He was General Counsel of the Federal Communication Commission, Research Director of the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He's authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Bill Clinton. He's the author of American Empire Before the Fall. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about these extrajudicial killings and how they will impact Yemen. It's been mismanaged with great skill. Terror believes on his eyes, and his eyes, they just tell him lies. But there's a woman on my blood. She just sits there in a cold chill, and she says, who gonna take away his license to kill? Martha's name, Martha's name, Martha's name,
ما نفعل شي فاصل
ما تصمل ما تصمل
اش خزراني لو نجلس تجل زاد مصرو تونس
ما تصمل ما تصمل
معتصمين وسط الساحة لنعد للشعب فرحة محلى الشارع وصباحة عيش الفهمة والراحة
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sheila Carapico, who's Professor of Political Science at the University of Richmond, and she's a visiting professor at the American University in Cairo. She's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her forthcoming book is titled Political Aid, Democracy Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Carapico.
Nice to be with you.
And the killing of al-Awlaki in Yemen, along with a propagandist for Inspire, which is an al-Qaeda online magazine, both of whom are American citizens, do you consider those extrajudicial executions of American citizens?
I do, yes, although I understand that there it's possible to construct an argument for the legality of the operation under the international so-called rules of war, in which it is legitimate to kill an operational commander. And I think that's why we've seen kind of a title inflation for Anwar al-Awlaki in the past couple of days to try to bolster the rules of war argument. So I think it's illegal under, in my opinion, under American law, but that an argument for legality can be constructed under international law.
But there's certainly no protests in this country, at least in manifesting in the mainstream press. American public, if anything, are celebrating the death of these two.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a almost a threat inflation or looking for successes against al-Qaeda after all this time. And so, you know, I mean, this person has almost kind of mystical attributes, and therefore I think people are rejoicing, not the killing of this person, but rather the destruction of the myth that he's been made into.
So since you're a student of Yemen, Sheila Carapico, again, professor of political science at the University of Richmond and visiting professor at the American University in Cairo, obviously the government of Yemen is very frail and it's sort of teetering on civil war, and there are continued military attacks between the military loyal to the 33-year-long dictatorship of President Saleh, who has just returned from Saudi Arabia. What's happening in terms of, because I think the Saleh's military are trying to take co-credit for this, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the president, and it's almost so much a series of coincidences that I think it inspires some conspiracy theories inside of Yemen. But, you know, he only returned to Yemen very recently. He immediately was able to give an interview with Time magazine that was also run in the Washington Post, in which he was boasting of his cooperation with the American military, and then by insinuation also the support that the American military has been giving to his administration. So here I think he is scoring a propaganda coup out of this assassination on two fronts. One is kind of claiming credit for it, and the other one is presenting himself as somebody who is indispensable to the United States in its counterterror campaign.
Well, there seems to be some within al-Qaeda itself. There seems to be a bit of a division between al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the headquarters, obviously, who've lost their main man in bin Laden. And there are reports that Ayman al-Zawahiri and others were a little jealous of the attention that al-Awlaki was getting and didn't consider him one of the real movers and shakers of the movement. Do you have any understanding of rifts within the organization?
You know, I don't follow al-Qaeda itself very closely, but, you know, I don't think it's quite an organization in the way we think of, say, you know, a bank or corporation or fraternity or something like that. And al-Zawahiri presumably still considers himself to be of a much higher rank than Anwar al-Awlaki was. And at the same time, it appears that one of the reasons why al-Awlaki was able to get so much attention in this country is because, of course, a lot of what he puts out is in English, and a lot, frankly, a lot of our supposed terrorism experts don't actually know Arabic, and so he's much more accessible. And I think that gave him both kind of a panache among the intelligence community, as well as, of course, the ability to communicate with jihadist wannabes anywhere in the world who read English better than they read Arabic, or understand English better than they understand Arabic.
So this government that's taking credit along with the United States, and I take it the U.S., if it doesn't have a strong presence in terms of boots on the ground in Yemen, it certainly its headquarters are just across in Djibouti. I think that's where these drones fly out of. There was also a report, Sheila Karapiko, that the convoy containing Awalaki and the other fellow who was the propagandist and
Khan,
yeah, he's an American-born of Pakistani descent. They were traveling in a convoy and they were supposedly hit by Predator missiles from two drones. There was also an earlier report of jet fighters being involved. Would that be possible? American fighters could come in and bomb from Djibouti?
I mean, I think it's technically possible, but I've also seen reports, and I'm not able to independently confirm these, you know, that the United States has kind of hastily built another base for these Predator drones either in Yemen or somewhere on the peninsula, so that there presumably are at least two bases from which weapons are being dispatched to Yemen in order to track down these al-Qaeda suspects.
But don't we have bigger problems here than these two that were killed by the U.S.? I mean, the whole place is falling apart, isn't it? It's on the brink of civil war. You have defecting military units being attacked by the military units loyal to Saleh and his sons, who've been running the place, I take it, until Saleh just returned from Saudi Arabia, where he was being treated for wounds where he was fairly badly disfigured from an attack back, I think, in March. So there are lots of reports that Yemen is poised to become a failed state. If that becomes the case, then surely it's all bets are off in terms of al-Qaeda, isn't it? Wouldn't that be like they'd be flocking in like they did to Afghanistan?
Well, actually, you just asked several questions.
Sorry about that, yeah.
That's okay. Starting briefly with the last one, I mean, I think early this year we had an amazing number of reports to the effect that so-called AQAP for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was the foremost threat to the American homeland, and that does appear to have been a very useful recruiting tool for this group, this guy Khan. Well, he's not that recently, but, I mean, there's evidence that those announcements have attracted again, jihadist wannabes or al-Qaeda wannabes from other parts of the world into Yemen. I mean, so that's one dangerous development. The other thing is that in addition to the factors that you mentioned, where there's dissenting military commanders are now fighting against the forces commanded by the president's sons and nephews, I mean, there's also this very dynamic and significant pro-democracy movement in the streets. And there seems to be a kind of contradiction between two different American policies, one of which, at least publicly, has been urging President Ali Abdullah Saleh to step aside in keeping with a proposal brought by the Saudi-led Gulf Cooperation Council. So on the one hand, presumably, at least to some extent, the United States is siding with the protesters. On the other hand, this move, again, appears to strengthen the hand of the president and his regime. And so I think that the United States doesn't actually have a very clear policy towards Yemen and is, in a certain way, pursuing two different policies that on the ground in Yemen seem very contradictory.
Because the U.S. Ambassador and other ambassadors apparently recently calmed things down, and when things look like a full-scale civil war about to break out, and you get the impression that a deal's been in place there for some time, but Saleh won't take the deal because he doesn't want to talk to the opposition. I mean, what's going on in terms of the impasse here and all of these deals that have been brokered by Western embassies?
Well, I think they're mainly being brokered, actually, by the Gulf Cooperation Council and particularly Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
What Saleh is now saying is that he won't sign until there's also a guarantee that the rogue elements of the military and also particular leaders of his own tribe, actually, this Al-Ahmar family, that unless he has a guarantee that they won't be allowed to take part in a transitional government, certainly to lead a transitional government, he's saying that for him to resign while they're still armed would amount to acquiescing to a military coup. And therefore, he is reluctant to resign. I mean, I think the bottom line is that he's reluctant to resign. He, I think, sincerely believes that he and or his sons and nephews are the only people qualified to lead Yemen. And again, I think he fundamentally believes, in spite of a certain amount of evidence to the contrary, that he has the backing of the Gulf Cooperation Council, as well as the United States and other NATO countries. So he's pretty stubborn, and in a way, I mean, this operation, killing al-Awlaki and the other fellow, and a couple of other people, at least one other person, I mean, it's kind of oblique intervention into an extremely complicated domestic situation that's very fast-moving, as you suggest, that's very much at risk of unraveling. And the analogy that comes to my mind is, whereas we usually say adding fuel to a fire, I think in this case we're adding fire to a fuel. There's plenty of fuel on the ground. And I find it rather reckless to be undertaking military operations under circumstances of such extreme uncertainty and instability inside of a country that is important to American strategic interests.
Again, I'm speaking with Sheila Carapico, who's a professor of political science at the University of Richmond, and she's also a visiting professor at the American University in Cairo and the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. So what is the U.S. doing on the other side of the ledger? You're saying that their military actions are exacerbating in a very tenuous political situation. There's a lot of a tinderbox situation, and we're, you know, throwing sparks around. What about what's happening on the other side in terms of, you mentioned the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Saudis trying to broker some kind of a deal? This has been going on for months now. What is the U.S. doing on the other side if there's some diplomatic pushback, people presumably expressing what you just expressed, which is, you know, we've got to stabilize this country's politics?
I mean, I haven't seen the U.S. doing that much. I mean, of course, our ambassador to Yemen, I mean, is closely involved. He's monitoring things. He's talking to people. I take it at his word, trying to use his influence to broker a solution. But what we have not seen is any other diplomatic effort from the United States. I mean, the only person that we've heard reported has gone to Yemen to deal with the crisis is a counterterrorism expert, not a diplomat. I mean, we haven't heard anything about somebody in the State Department, you know, being charged with trying to work out a solution to the Yemen impasse. We have not, certainly we don't have the kind of, obviously we don't have anything close to talking about a Libya-style intervention or sanctions of the sort that at least the Europeans are looking at in Syria. So the United States' response to the pro-democracy uprising in Yemen has been very weak, tepid, limpid, something like that, and indirect. I think our main policy there is really to back the Saudi initiative rather than to take an American initiative.
But there's probably a little distance between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in the sense that the Saudis, the last thing they want is the Arab Spring spreading inside their country, and they're using enormous amounts of their oil revenues to essentially buy off the younger generation who are very dissatisfied with the restrictive kind of theocratic rules and want to live a more modern life, and we know women want to drive, etc. So they have, they wouldn't be very sympathetic to the Yemeni democratic movement, would they? Because that's the very, very same movement they're trying to extinguish in their own country.
And in Bahrain. I mean, no, I think it's very clear. In fact, I mean, to me, it's a real enigma what exactly the Saudis want, or if they're in fact of one mind. But I think it's reasonably clear that the Saudi royal family, the last thing they want to see is a successful pro-democracy movement in Yemen. And even when they're urging Ali Abdullah Saleh to resign, presumably, I mean, they have repeated that many times, but it's not clear what they want to have happen next, or if they have, you know, a favorite among the top contenders to take power. And so, I mean, personally, I don't share. Hillary Clinton and other members of the Obama administration have repeatedly expressed faith in the Saudi/Gulf Cooperation Council initiative for Yemen, the so-called deal that Saleh continually refuses to sign. I find that to be a very kind of half-baked proposal that doesn't have a clear outcome. And as you say, I mean, it's very unlikely that what the Saudis want to have happen in Yemen is for there to be a burgeoning democracy.
Well, just to summarize in closing then, Sheila Karapiga, the country of Yemen is poised to be a failed state on the brink of civil war. The U.S.'s diplomacy is tied to a Saudi initiative that really does not want to respect the wishes of the democratic movement that have been taken to the streets and are being shot at by Saleh and his family. And we're only focused largely on al-Qaeda. But what seems logical to me is if we do not support the democracy movement, at the end of the day, we are inviting al-Qaeda. We're, in fact, creating our own nemesis. Is that a summary?
I think that we are glamorizing al-Qaeda at the same time as we are alienating the pro-democracy elements in Yemen. And that's a very unfortunate pair of signals to be sending in a country like Yemen.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sheila Karapiga.
Good talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sheila Karapiga, who is a professor of political science at the University of Richmond. She's also a visiting professor at the American University in Cairo and the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with Chris Hedges, who will ask the question, are you a rebel or a slave?
If we walk away, they'll walk away. But greed is a bottomless pit. And our freedom's a joke, we're just taking. And the whole world must watch the sad comic display. If you're still free, start running away. 'Cause we're coming for you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Hedges, the author of a new book, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. In 2002, he's part of the team at the New York Times that won the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of global terrorism. He was also received the Amnesty International Global Award for Human Rights. Now he writes primarily about America and the Middle East and politics and society. His books include War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, What Every Person Should Know About War, American Fascists, The Christian's Right and the War on America, and Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
And we clearly are in a moment here where there may be awakening. We've just been talking about early in the program about the extrajudicial killing of two American citizens that have been largely celebrated in this country. With a constitutional lawyer and a specialist on Yemen, we talked a little bit about the Arab Spring in terms of Yemen and the extent to which we are not necessarily on the side of the Arab Spring because we're tied to the Saudi peace process that's going nowhere. In terms of our own country, there are sort of rumors or rumblings that there's something that's going on that's even being described as the American Autumn. Do you think, do you feel this is happening?
I think it could. The tinder is there and it has been there for some time. What's the spark that's going to set it alight? I think this may be it. You know, I've spent a lot of time down with the protesters occupying Wall Street and I'm pretty impressed. They're incredibly well organized. They're very smart. They're very savvy. They've thought all this stuff through carefully. And most importantly, they're resilience is amazing. They're not going anywhere.
And do you think that will inspire more people to join their ranks?
It already has. We've already seen movements, copycat movements in San Francisco, Boston, even Tampa, Florida, Chicago.
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Whether it's going to grow, how it's going to grow, these are just unknowns. I mean, even the organizers themselves don't know. But these corporations know only one word, and that's more. They will push and push and push, and take and take and take as much as they can, you know, until there's nothing left. And the only mechanism we have, to resist is through civil disobedience. The traditional, formal structures of power do not work, including the Democratic Party, the electoral system, the judiciary, legislative branch, the systems of communications are wholly owned subsidiaries of the corporate state. The organizers in Wall Street and around the country have woken up to that fact.
So who is apart from yourself, is putting out this simple message, which I think people probably in a kind of inchoate, nascent way, they understand the disparity of wealth is growing. They understand their own lives are getting more and more difficult. They understand the middle class is shrinking. They understand the enormous number of people that are out of work. But the simple kind of message that you're putting across of how we've almost become slaves to a corporate oligarchy and our politics are completely captured by money and that there is an alternative, that the only way to take America back from its capture by the oligarchs and their money through their political shills is for the people to show up. The political process is still alive, isn't it? I mean, the Constitution's alive. The tools are there. It's just the will that's lacking.
The Constitution, I mean, you know, the legal system has been completely perverted, rewritten, reformed, reconfigured to serve the interests of the corporate state and the security and surveillance state, which, of course, is a natural outgrowth of the corporate state. First, they rule through fraud, and when the fraud is exposed, they rule through force. I mean, who's out there? I think that there are certainly movements and people out there, Adbusters, these kinds of groups that get it, although it's a Canadian group. In terms of, you know, writers and intellectuals, we're a pretty small number. Cornel West has been supportive and outspoken in his critique of the Obama administration and the Democratic Party. But in terms of those of us who have been calling for some time for an abandonment of traditional politics and exclusive forms of civil disobedience, you know, we're a small group. However, I think if you look at the grassroots efforts that are fueling these movements, all of these people have a political consciousness that the, you know, the mandarins who purport to sort of dominate our intellectual life don't have.
Well, Chris Hedges, again, we're talking about Chris's call in his article, At Truth Dig, The Best Among Us, asking, are we rebels or slaves? And in the context of the growing protest movement in this country against Wall Street, against the disparity in wealth, against the shrinkage of the middle class, against the war on working America, and also the war on the environment. I mean, you can't, these things are entwined. The right wing press in this country are just loving this whole idea of Solyndra being a an example of some kind of weird evidence to suggest that we don't need to have a problem with global warming. The Republicans almost shut down the government over $1.6 billion in trying to increase mileage efficiency and decrease global warming. You can see the Koch brothers have essentially bought the political process. And on the other side, you've got Obama desperately trying to raise money from Wall Street, who are apparently going to give all their money to Mitt Romney. And so is there any in this forthcoming election, in terms of the choices, is there any chance that there'll be a choice here? Will the people step up and support somebody, or will the oligarchs buy the next round?
I think the point, the broader point, is that it doesn't matter who you support. Either you serve corporate interests or you're out. And Obama has served corporate interests as assiduously as did George W. Bush.
But what about us doing that, Chris? I mean, I can't understand why people buy brawny paper towels and Dixie cups and support the Koch brothers. They're at war with the average American. They're trying to impoverish our lives. They are on the attack.
Impoverish. I mean, you know, the protesters are very right to twin this to the environmental crisis, because the same forces that are reconfiguring American society into a kind of neo-feudalism that are going after, you know, the education budget and Social Security because they want that money for themselves, are destroying the ecosystem on which the human species depends for life. And there is no force, party, politician, mechanism within the structures of power that are going to stop them. The only way we're going to stop them is to do what we're doing, and that is to get out into the street. And frankly, we don't have very much time left. The pace of global warming and the effects of global warming, in fact, are far greater and far more accelerated than were predicted by most climate scientists. Forests are dying. Temperatures are rising. The polar ice caps are melting. We are enduring freak weather patterns, hurricanes, droughts, tornadoes, and they'll kill us because the only mantra they chant is profit, profit, profit. And they're too stupid and too blind to realize that they will be exterminated with the rest of us. I mean, that's really the point that we face. And they get it. I mean, they get it in these plazas. They get it in these streets. The political system doesn't work. And to sit around and talk about who you're going to vote for, or, you know, what the Republicans' debate said, or, and this is just an utter, complete waste of time. It's what they want, because the power systems themselves are not in any way inconvenienced, monitored, regulated, controlled, or inhibited by either of the two major political parties. And I know from having spent a lot of time in the Wall Street protests that everybody in Liberty Plaza knows, gets that.
But Chris Hedges, then, what about the idea of doing what you can to take money away from, your money away from the Koch brothers? If the Koch brothers...
That's good, but it's broader than that, too. We have to break the whole cycle of the consumer society. We have to break what the corporate state has instilled in us, which is consumption, as a kind of inner compulsion. We have to recover other values of thrift, of simplicity, humility, in order to reorient the way we relate to each other and to the wider world if we are going to survive as a species. So, yeah, you're very right. I mean, don't buy anything owned by the Koch brothers, although they own a lot. But it's broader than that. Disconnect as fast and as much as possible from the consumer culture.
Well, if it's, as if we needed any evidence, I recently, Chris Hedges, interviewed Ellen Schultz, who's a veteran reporter with the Wall Street Journal. She's written a book called Retirement Heist about how pensions are being stolen by corporations. It is the most heartbreaking book. I mean, to realize the callousness out there.
Yeah.
And I don't understand in this country how it is that we have this class society. I mean, they, you know, all the right-wing press are crying foul, class warfare, class warfare. It's such an absurdity since the wealthy have already won, and arguably we're all prisoners of war, of a class war that they've won.
I spent a lot of time, Ian, talking in Death of the Liberal Class, which goes all the way back to World War One, about the concerted and organized destruction of populist and radical movements, whether the Wobblies, the old CIO, the Communist Party, Eugene Debs, and then the disemboweling of liberal institutions, that going after figures like Henry Wallace in 19 ran for president in 48, used to be Roosevelt's vice president, as being soft on communism. That is just the way that they broke all of the traditional institutions that made incremental and piecemeal reform possible, and essentially killed the system. And what is so inspiring about these movements is that although they don't always know the history, they have found the spirit of and the importance of rebellion. That the question is not, as Karl Popper pointed at, how do we get good people to rule? That's the wrong question. Most people attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is, how do we stop the power elite from doing as much damage as possible? And that comes through movements that make the power elite frightened. And frankly, the power elite in the financial district of New York City is terrified. They have turned Lower Manhattan into the green zone. Barricaded every street, dozens and dozens of police paddy wagons, patrol cars, motorcycle police. It's just staggering. But they understand far better than even you or I do how utterly corrupt and gamed the system is. And what they don't want is for the rest of the country, what the protesters call the 99%ers, which is us, to have that kind of consciousness. Because we do have a power in numbers to bring them down. But that's not going to be by going to the voting booth.
But Chris Hedges, in all of these movements, if you go back to the anti-slavery movement, there was a religious and moral component here. And that's what I'm wondering about, is whether there's any traction in a discussion about what it means to be an American, what our society is, whether we do have a society. If you have this 1% that extracts all the wealth for themselves, and just going back to Ellen Schultz's book, Retirement Heist, the systematic way in which they have looted the pensions of all of these people who worked all of their lives and paid into these pensions, and then they take all the money away through sleight of hand and through legislative games that they've played in so-called pension reform in the Congress, and then they take all this money and give it to themselves, and they've already got tons and tons of money. The only people who are getting pensions now in corporate America are the executives.
Right. Well, I mean, that's just a window into the
Exactly. It's a window, but I'm saying, what is it about these people that see themselves as being more valuable than their fellow Americans? And what is it about?
What qualities does a corporation celebrate? Psychopaths. The same qualities that are celebrated in popular culture on reality television. you know,
a Donald Trump type of thing where, you know,
sure,
you're fired.
And
you know,
an ability of, for manipulation, for a kind of false sincerity, for self-aggrandizement, an incapacity for remorse or guilt, utterly, using any kind of friendships or bonds of trust as, essentially stepping stones for your own. I mean, these are the values that are celebrated at Goldman Sachs and Citibank and everywhere else and replicated in sort of popular manifestations on shows, on television. The only time we ever see poor people, on the corporate media is when they appear on shows like Jerry Springer and we laugh at them. These people are sick. Look, I went to school with a lot of them. I got a scholarship to a boarding school when I was 10. Part of my anger at the power elite is that I know who they are. I mean, I have friends who work at BlackRock. I know these people. And they are sick, demented, selfish, and in some cases, patently evil. And they will take your pensions. Look, we live in a country where it is now legally permissible for corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That's the kind of world we live in. And we've got to get out and take it back.
But what does it say about us, Chris, that we let this happen? This is only the 1%. There's 99% of us.
I don't want to keep slugging my books, but I mean, Empire of Illusion is about how we are the most illusioned society on the face of the planet. We are awash in electronic hallucinations. We are fed a form of magical thinking that the reality is never an impediment to whatever we desire. Oprah does it. The Christian right does it. The self-help gurus like Tony Robbins do it. Positive psychologists do it. Hollywood does it. If we just dig deep enough within ourselves, if we focus on happiness, if we grasp that we are truly exceptional, if we believe in Jesus, we'll have everything we want. And that is the mantra that is just pumped out over the airwaves hour after hour after hour. And it is kind of a collective hypnosis, mass self-delusion.
And of course, it's the antithesis of political action.
It's been effective in terms of disempowerment. But now, I mean, a lot of these young people down in Liberty Square, they're highly educated. I mean, they've all done everything right. They've gone to great schools and they got out there and they didn't want to become tools for Wall Street.
But is that the next movement? Is it possible because these kids don't have jobs because corporate America has stolen so much that they don't even want to provide jobs like Henry Ford's adage? You know, you got to pay people enough to buy your product.
And remember, they're all in debt. They've got staggering debt.
Right. From these complete crooked schools that take taxpayer money, which the politicians have.
The hope now is that, you know, when I go to demonstrations in Washington with Veterans for Peace, God bless them, I'm the youngest person there often. But this is a youth-driven movement.
So you've got the kids that there's going to be more and more kids that can't get a job, and they've got this staggering debt from these crooked diploma mills that the Congress have set up and enabled. And then you've got the unions are joining these movements. So give us a sense, just in closing, Chris Hedges, of why you feel that given the choice between being a rebel or a slave, there may be a few more rebels stepping up.
Because even if the New York City police go in within an hour and shut this whole thing down, we've won. Because within the DNA of everyone who's been there, and at this point we're talking about several thousand people, they have been provided with an alternative vision. Not only of community, because they're highly organized, but it's non-hierarchical. It's pretty amazing. Pretty impressive. But they've recognized that they're not alone. And one of the things that the corporate state has worked so assiduously to do is to make sure we are all atomized, disconnected from each other. And I mean, you know, disconnected physically. Because when you sit in front of a computer screen or you tweet or watch your TV, or you're still alone. And those people who came to Liberty Plaza aren't alone, and they know they're not alone. And the communal bond that has been created is what is most dangerous to the power elite. And that's already started. So I've been a reporter too long to tell you where this is going to go. I don't know. Nobody knows where it's going to go. But at this point, there aren't any excuses left. Either you get out and support this movement, and that means you get out in the street, you get out with your body, or you become complicit in a monstrous evil.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Hedges, the author of the new book, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. He was a part of the 2002 New York Times team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize, and he's the author of a number of books, and he has an article at Truthdig, The Best Among Us, that asks rhetorically whether or not we are rebels or slaves. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? We began talking with U.S. constitutional lawyer Bruce Fein, who was a deputy attorney general in the Reagan administration. He's the author of American Empire Before the Fall. He actually described or equated the U.S. government's killing of two U.S. citizens in Yemen the same as Putin killing the KGB defector in London using polonium to poison him. And he feels that this will give a license to our enemies abroad to attack us with impunity. That the whole idea of due process and has literally gone out the window, and that we, even in World War II, we at least gave Nazi saboteurs a trial before we executed them, but now using predator drones, we can zap anybody, including zapping people in the United States, which is not inconceivable. He asked the rhetorical question whether or not American people would, in fact, give away their civil liberties if the president said there's an impending al-Qaeda attack and we've got to suspend all of rights to meet this attack, a scary possibility. Then Sheila Karapika, who's a specialist on Yemen at the American University in Cairo, she talked about the impact inside Yemen, which, you know, is adding a spark to a tinderbox there. We should be dealing with trying to bring the country together and supporting the democracy movement, not inflaming things. And then finally, we talked with Chris Hedges about what might be the American autumn in terms of the Arab Spring. And he basically asked the question in terms of the Wall Street protesters, who he thinks everybody in this country should join. He asked the question, are you a rebel or a slave? I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.